The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with the continuation of the nicest places in America. Last time we were doing, let's see what the name of the place was here, Coulterville, California. Now we're at the Kingsport Carousel in Kingsport, Tennessee, and there's a picture of an old-fashioned carousel, and it is gorgeous. There's lions and tigers and striped horses. I mean, it's really fancy. The happiest place in Kingsport, Tennessee has horses, a tiger, a giraffe, and even a dragon. Has chariots and a large buffalo that lets kids climb all over it. It has laughter that drowned out the speaker's toe-tapping music. If Kingsport's carousel sounds magical, that's because it is. Located in downtown Kingsport, it's the crown jewel of the small city on the Virginia border. But the real magic is how it came to be built and lovingly crafted by the people of Kingsport themselves, most of whom had no idea how to wield a chisel, let alone fashion a carousel. It began 14 years ago when Kingsport transplant Gail Yeo wanted to give back to the place that had become his home. Originally from Birmingham to New York, the carousel capital of the world, Yeo spent his youth riding the city's half-dozen carousels. Kings and Kingsport should know the same joy, he thought. So in 2008, he proposed the pipe dream to a city alderman. She scoffed at the cost, declaring, "Kingsport will have a carousel when pigs fly." That alderman happened to be his wife. Undeterred, Yeo turned to his local Kiwanis Club. Reggie Martin, Milton Nelson, George Gibson, and Ted Hellick, the Four Horsemen, shared Yeo's enthusiasm. They weren't the carpenters and mechanics Kingsport needed, but they were the problem solvers. The horsemen attended the wood carving classes 3.5 hours away in Chattanooga to learn to carve carousel statues. Giving selflessly for the greater good is nothing new in Kingsport. In fact, they have a term for it, the Kingsport spirit. Kingsport was chiseled out of the Appalachian Mountains on the trail of the Industrial Revolution. People came from all around to make a new beginning for themselves, and with them they brought an old-school work ethic infused with the spirit of understanding and generosity, and the aim of improving everyone's quality of life. The carousel represents that so well, says Jeff Fleming, Visit Kingsport's relocation manager. The horsemen returned from Chattanooga as adept carvers, and the city gifted a facility uses a workshop. The carousel project found its hooves. Then suddenly, Gail Yeo passed from Lewy body dementia in 2010. Yeo's dream wouldn't die with him. Instead, donations flowed. The horsemen taught volunteers to sculpt. Each statue takes about a year. And a local artist taught them to paint. Sculptures took on characteristics of their carvers. Valerie Yeo carved several, including a pig with wings. How appropriate. Next, they need a frame, a floor, poles, sweeps, rounding boards, gears, and an electric motor to house the statues. In 2011, word of the volunteer carousel effort reached a Connecticut zoo, which donated an old frame sitting in storage, and a Kingsport shipping company offered a free ride in an empty truck that just happened to be returning from New York. 2 days and a truckload of neatly disassembled parts later, Kingsport carousel frame was on its way. When faced with an obstacle, we'd put out to the universe in our community, and a solution would arrive, says Bonnie McDonald, Kingsport's former cultural arts administrator. Just as volunteer artists emerged, so did mechanics to reassemble the frame. Helig, a chemist by trade, built flooring for the entire platform. In 2015, after 7 years with the help of 300 volunteers and 700 sponsors, the Kingsport carousel was ready to ride. A lilting, whirling work of art, it stands as a symbol of both the extraordinary gumption and fun for fun's sake. High schoolers borrow the carousel as a photo backdrop every prom. It's a favorite field trip destination for Girls Incorporated of Kingsport, an after-school program. It's the go-to for date nights, proposals, and sunny afternoons. We're not the carousel capital of the U.S. That's still Binghamton, says McDonald. But when it came time to make a carousel, we had all the talent we needed right here. The next nicest place in America, the Lucky Candied Bodega in the Bronx, New York. And there's a picture of a young man named Ahmad Alwan has helped behind the counter of his family store since he was 11 years old. And he's a good-looking young man. He's got a baseball cap on backwards, wearing a hoodie, and pointing his fingers towards himself. The challenge is simple. Answer a math question. Say what's 8 by 8 by 50. You get 5 seconds to grudge as much as you can from Lucky Candle Bodega shelves, all for free. The Ahmed Betty All 123. Joy is an essential as breakfast, and regulars at his family's corner store sometimes struggle for both. So it came with a clever way to brighten his customers' days. I've always helped out people in the neighborhood, he says. They've known me since I was a little kid. I know half of them by name, and you know sometimes they need credit. Lucky Candy is located on a busy street in the Bronx, which is what's known as a food desert, where affordable, healthy food is scarce. Many residents rely on neighborhood shops like Lucky Candy for their daily needs. Enter the Bodega Challenge. When a young math whiz gets an answer right, one of two things usually happens. Cumpkins dart for the candy, and who could blame them? Others grab things like rice, oranges, and potatoes, clearly thinking of family at home. They're doing something good, Berto, a student who stopped by after school, told Inside Edition, because here we see a lot of people who don't have anything. All one covers the sprees with his paycheck, but his boss, a.k.a. his father, Saleh Ahabad, doesn't mind chipping in too. The Yemeni immigrant Ahabad knows that one of the toughest, most competitive places in the U.S., a bit of help goes a long way. This changed our relationship with the community big time, says Alwyn. They're showing so much love, and they're lining up at the store for a chance to play. Our finalist. Over the past 6 years, our readers have brought some very special locations to our attention for the nicest place in America. This year's winner and finalist are shown on the map above, and the map shows the three things in California, New York, and Virginia border. You can read about our past bidders at rd.com, where we are already collecting nominations for 2023. Since this will be broadcast on the day after Halloween, I guess these following soldiers are kind of appropriate. A soldier's ghost story. The World War II veteran had a mysterious visitor who showed up at his bedside with a clear, comforting message. For months, as I visited Evan at his hospice social worker, he's been praying to die. He's in his 90s, and he's been fighting cancer for more than 4 years. As he sees it, his life has turned into a tedious, meaningless dirge, with nothing to look forward to other than its end. On this visit, though, he'd engaged in upbeat. The sudden about-face arouses my suspicions. "You seem to feel differently today," I said casually. "What's going on?" He looks at me cryptically. "Do you believe in ghosts?" he asks. It's not the first time a patient has asked me this. People can have unusual experiences when they reach the end of life. Visitations from spiritual beings, messages delivered in dreams, synchronicities, or strange behavior by animals, birds, even insects. "There are all kinds of ghosts," I respond seriously. "What kind are you talking about?" "You remember me telling you about the war?" he asks. How could I forget? He traced his long-standing depression to his time as a supply officer of a World War II combat hospital. "I remember. There's something I left out," he says. "Something I can't explain." He goes on to describe one horrific ice-cold autumn day. Casualties were coming in nonstop. He and the others scrambled to transport blood-soaked men on stretchers to triage. I'd been hustling all day. My back felt broken and my hands were numb from the cold. He grimaces and swallows hard. "We were hauling one guy, and my grip on the stretcher slipped." Tears rolled down his face. When he hit the ground, his intestines oozed out. Steam rose up from them as he died. Evan rubs his hands as though they were still cold. Later that night, I was on my cot crying. I couldn't stop crying about that poor guy and all the others I'd seen die. My cot was creaking. I was shaking so hard. I nod, waiting for him to continue. "Then I looked up," he says. "Saw a guy sitting on the end of my cot. He was wearing a World War I uniform with one of those funny helmets." Evan starts crying and laughing at the same time. "He was looking at me with love. I could feel it. I'd never felt that kind of love before." "What was it like?" He pauses. "I guess I just felt like all the pain and cruelty wasn't what was real." "What was real?" "Knowing that no matter how cruel the world looks on some level, somehow, we are all loved. We are all connected." This turned out to be the first of several paranormal visits. Each time the specter arrived, he would wordlessly express love and leave Evan with a sense of peace and calm. "After the war, the visit stopped," he says. Years later, I was cleaning out Mom's stuff after she died, and I found an old photograph. It was the same guy. I looked on the back, and Mom had written the words, "Uncle Calvin, killed during World War I in 1918. We talked some more. Then I asked, "What does this have to do with your being in a better mood?" "He's back," he whispers. "Saw him last night at the foot of my bed. He spoke this time." "What'd he say?" "He told us he's going to help me over the hill when it's time to go." As I'm formulating more questions, Evan surprises me by asking one of his own. "Do you ever have something strange happen? Something that tells you no matter how bad it looks, you're connected to something bigger?" A memory from 35 years ago flashes into my mind. I was asleep in a graduate student apartment at Syracuse University. A siren's blare woke me. I sat up, adrenaline pumping, heart pounding like a hammer. From outside, I distinctly heard someone say, "Bring it here, quick." Then I heard a girding being rolled across asphalt. I went to the window and pulled back the curtain, certain there was trouble outside. No one was there. Just before daybreak, Dad called to tell me that a few hours earlier, my Uncle Eddie had been killed in an automobile collision. On the kitchen table sat a beat-up radio. It suddenly switched itself on, and I heard the opening chords of the Beatles song, "Let It Be." I never listened closely to the song before, but this time I did. The music and words filled me with an almost underworldly sense of peace and comfort. For years, I tried to explain away those events. Inside, though, a part of me knew they were real. After nearly 30 years as a hospice social worker, I'm certain of it, and I have patients like Evan to thank. Dying patients who have convinced me that the world we inhabit is lovingly, mysteriously, and eager to support us, especially during times of crises. I return to the present. Evans is looking at me, waiting for an answer to his question about connecting with something strange, something bigger. Outside, a flock of crows takes off in unison from the branches of an ancient oak. "Yeah," I said with a nod, "I guess I have." Your true stories. Supernatural visitors. Readers share their not-so-scary ghost stories. A hummingbird's hello. My sister Wendy once nursed and released an injured hummingbird. It became a thing, her and hummingbirds. As teenagers, we promised each other that if one of us died, she'd let the other know that she was okay. Wendy was the first to go at 48. Sitting outside one morning, I felt something repeatedly swoop low over my head. I yelled, "Wendy, if that's you, stop messing around and show me." And suddenly a hummingbird hovered in front of my face. When I told my daughter this story later that morning, she interrupted. "Mom, there's a hummingbird flying right over your head. It seemed so close I could have perched on my glasses." I said, "Hi, Wendy." She tweeted back and sped off. I haven't seen her since, but if I never do, that's fine. I know she's okay. Kathy Redmond, Port Orange, Florida. Bedtime stories. My kids were 9 and 8 years old when their grandpa passed. My daughter often said how much she missed him. We wondered why our son wasn't as expressive. We worried his reaction was almost too cold, until he said he didn't miss Grandpa because he saw him every night, when Grandpa sat in his bed and talked to him until he fell asleep. Karen Ivers. The graveyards, I can't read this, is a misprint here, I'm sorry, on the headline, sorry. We brought a small house on an acre of land that had been neglected after the owner died. Working alone in the yard one day, I felt 3 sound pats on my back. Later I learned the last owner had been a fanatic about keeping her yard neat. I think she was thanking me for getting him back into shape. Liest May, Stratham, Georgia. My mom died just before my birthday. We both loved greeting cards. We once had worked together at a stationery shop and sent each other plenty of cards over the years, even though we lived nearby and saw each other often. I finally revisited the stationery store months after her death. I had planned a quick search for the cards I wanted, hoping to avoid a surge in my grief. But I noticed that one card in the humor rack was glaringly out of place. It was pretty and floral, with no words on the cover. I opened it to find out where it belonged. It read, "Happy birthday, daughter. You're loved more than you can imagine." I read the verse again. It was exactly the card my mom would have sent for my birthday. I still have such experiences occasionally and wonder, coincidence or mom? I chose to believe it's mom. It reminded me that I'm loved more than I can imagine. Kathleen Sheets, Oregon, Ohio. Logan, Art, and I worked closely in a chemistry lab. After Logan retired, we still met often for lunch. Logan was a bachelor with no living family, so when he passed away, Art and I inherited his chemistry collection, old Bunsen burners, antique acid and base bottles, and textbooks from the 40s. In his memory, we assembled a display cabinet at the entrance to the lab. As Art slid Logan's photo into a frame we had been gifted, he said, "I wish Logan could see what we're doing with his prize collection." Suddenly the frame began playing, "Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot?" Yes, it played Auld Lang Syne. Art and I looked at each other in awe. We had no idea the frame even played music. We often talk about the wonderful way Logan let us know he was still around. Becky Boudreau, St. Anne, Illinois. The light inside my mom's garage comes on briefly when the door rises. Once we heard music when we pulled into the driveway. As we waited for the door to open, we saw several silhouettes dancing. I looked at Mom wide-eyed and asked, "Do you see that?" "Yes," she replied. "They're square dancing." We later learned that the land was once a park where people used to meet to square dance. CD via ArtReaderDigest.com. The show must go on. My sister Jean was a fun-loving tour bus enthusiast who thrived on traveling with friends and seeing the sights. On the anniversary of her unexpected death, I tossed and turned and cried most of the night. But the next morning I woke laughing. I had dreamed that a tour bus filled with adventurers stopped outside my window. Jean lowered her window, looked me in the eye, looked me eye to eye, and said in her most assertive voice, "I don't know what your problem is, but you need to get over it." She was too happy and having too much fun exploring for me not to get over it. Evelyn Cantrell, McFenville, Tennessee. The Big Good Night. My husband was the early bird to my night owl. Every evening he'd put his hands on the arms of my chair, envelop me as he kissed me goodnight. A year after his passing, I was in my chair watching TV when I felt this rush come toward me. Without a second thought, I opened my arms for a goodnight hug and a kiss. Susan Crawford, Monteca, California. Rescued by an old flame. When I was 8 years old, I slept at my grandmother's on a cold night. My grandmother, Papa, had passed years earlier. After Granny lit the kerosene heater in the kitchen, we fell asleep on her feather mattress. I was suddenly awakened by someone shaking my shoulder. The man smiled at me and said, "Wake up and wake Granny." Smoke hung in the air as I woke her. She leaped up and got the heater out of the kitchen door. She said, "Thank goodness you woke up." I told her a man shook my shoulder and told me to wake her. When I said he was smiling at me, she said it was probably Papa. I believe with all my heart that he saved us that night. Darlene Couch, Springfield, Ohio. Boogie Woogie Ghost. Everyone lost watching my parents boot scoot boogie across the dance floor. My dad passed way too young at 58. Months later, my mom went on a cruise, and while she was away, Dad came to me in a dream. He smiled and said, "Tell your mother her legs aren't what they used to be, and it's okay for her to dance." When Mom got back, I gave her Dad's message. She asked what day I had the dream. It turned out was the night of the ship's dance, where several potential partners approached her. She turned them all down because they weren't my dad. I hugged her and said, "Well, it's okay for you to dance." Becky Boudreau, St. Anne, Illinois. Welcome, Wedding Crasher. My grandmother passed away in August, a few months after suffering a stroke. On my wedding day, the following December, I found myself desperately wishing she were there. That night I dreamed of her, healthy and whole, at my wedding reception that afternoon. She said to me so clearly, "Michelle, you look stunning." I woke up with a smile and tears on my face. My wedding day was so happy and full of love, and there she was, the missing piece telling me she was there the whole time. Michelle Williams, Oceanside, California. What's the best you ever got, best advice you ever got? You know what they say, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Don't eat the yellow snow. The best things in life are free. So now's the time to be generous, sharing the good advice that helped you along in life. Your pearls can be directed to dear old dad, a mentor's mandate, or something you read in a book or heard in an interview. See the terms and share at rd.com/wisdom. Inspiration. 22 rivers across 22 states in 22 months. A lone canoeist crosses America in search of what binds us together. And there's a picture of a gentleman sitting in a canoe. Looks like he's probably in his 40s, maybe early 50s. It's got a red canoe and a big wooden paddle, and there's bubbles all around him, indicating he's in the water. Neil Morris descended from New York State's Mohawk River by a canoe, approaching the end of a journey that began 22 months and more than 7,000 miles ago. His paddle has plied 21 bottles of water so far on his way across the continent. Downstream always means easier paddling, yet dangers abound. Wedge up against a log or rock and the current will flip and sink his earthly good. All those upstream slogs were worse, of course. His eyes would scan the river for the calm seams of flat water, the points of land that subdued the stream and made it way less difficult. Lest he surrender hard-earned progress, he would dig and dig long past the burning of his shoulders in bidboarding and on into the long and stifling of freezing and wind-blown afternoon. 22 rivers, 22 states, 22 months of journeying has been his declared objective, stringing together rivers and the people along them to see what still connects us as Americans in divided times. At evening, sunset often beams upon a chosen spit of sand. The rivers show him where to camp. He likes island for their safety from animals, but also from people. An hour before nightfall, he unloads his gear, pitches his tent, fixes some supper, maybe cracks a beer. And then he dines in perfect solitude, seated upon an overturned plastic bucket, watching the timeless mystery of day becoming night. Music of coyotes, crickets, frogs, the silent coming of fireflies from across the water, piling into the willows above his head. He turns in early, marveling at the strength in his 49-year-old limbs, which increases by the day. He will himself awake an hour before dawn, and in concert with the first hope of rays of morning, he will push off into the stream, leaving nothing behind but the notch in the coarse sand where his canoe has passed the sacred night. When Moore was 13, old, growing up in Los Angeles, his older brother Tom, who he adored, crashed his Mustang and died from his injuries. Devastated, Moore passed his teenage years in a spiraling funk. Drugs, attempted suicide, made worse when his beloved brother was diagnosed with breast cancer and began a slow decline. His father was a fifth-generation Mormon, whose pioneering ancestors had led a company of handcart-toting immigrants across the prairie to Utah. Now with her health dwindling and her son hopelessly adrift, his mother stated her dying wish for Moore to serve a 2-year mission to spread the gospel, as is traditional for devout Mormons before he turned high school and college. Moore was anything but devout, but his mother wanted him to do something transformative, to do something pure. If she died while he was away, he was not to come home for the funeral. Surprising even himself, he went. His assignment was South Africa, 1991 to 1993. During his first month in the field, he got the phone call he'd been dreading. His mother had passed. Honoring her request, he stayed on. The mission changed his life. In South Africa, he learned to live outside his dark thoughts, to serve wholeheartedly, to walk freely among strangers and learn their stories, to shake hands African style, thumb upward, to smile and mean it. When you put yourself out of your comfort zone, he concluded, this is when extraordinary things can happen. This is when you learn and grow. Over the next decades, he lived as an expatriate, teaching English in Taiwan, selling antiques in South Africa, adventuring in Egypt, then heading into Ethiopia's broiling heat, and back for a visit with his homeland in 2009 for a paddle down the length of the Mississippi River to see how the middle of America was faring during the Great Recession. This despite never having previously spent more than an afternoon in a canoe. Cancer had taken his mother, and in 2012 it tried to take him too. He needed surgery, which left him unable to walk. Over the course of months, he crawled and then stood and then took a few shuffling paces, then got to where he could walk once again, trek for miles. From overseas, after the 2016 election, he watched division and rancor affect his beloved country. He needed to rediscover America, to see what still held it together. His 50th birthday was approaching. Cancer would be back for him, he knew it. He'd love to plan an absolute banger of an excursion without wife or children who'd miss him. He had the luxury of time, and he knew exactly how to use it. He'd traverse the continent by canoe. The open canoe would not only honor the continent's first inhabitants, it would put as little possible between himself and the world. Rather than following the path of Lewis and Clark, he would reverse it and keep going, Pacific to Atlantic. The trip would need some kind of flourishing at the end, and he knew just a thing, a victory wrapped around the Statue of Liberty, symbol of the American people who were what this trip was about. And there's a picture of him in his canoe. Boy, he's got a bunch of stuff in there. He's got, looks like a cart with wheels and all kinds of stuff. And there's people on the side waving at him. On February 9th, 2020, Moore sets out from Astoria, Oregon, at the mouth of the Columbia River. He packs a tent, a sleeping bag, jugs of water, and a bucket of freeze-dried meals, then points his bright red 16-foot Old Town canoe upstream. He starts poling, 1,078 uphill miles to the Continental Divide in Montana, the rivers, the Columbia, the Snake, the St. Joe, the Clark Fork, portage over the divide, then the 8th month 3,600-mile downhill run to New Orleans, rivers of the Missouri, the Mississippi, the final leg, 2,890 miles in almost a year, east along the waters of the Gulf, then up through Alabama, Tennessee, and Kentucky, up to Lake Erie, across New York to Albany, then down to the Big Apple, rivers and waterways of the Gulf of Mexico, the Mobile, the Tombigbee, the Tintom, the Tennessee, the Ohio, the Kentucky, the Kanawha, the Allegheny, the Chattahoochee, and the Lake Erie, Erie Canal, Seneca, Oneida, Mohawk, and the Hudson. Dodging barges and container ships, startling grizzlies, bumped hard by a bull shark, escorted by dolphins, curious alligators, twice capsized, days and days too windy to paddle, sleet, downpours, floods, spectacular breathtaking scenery, and every day that involuntary laugh of the free man reveling in his element. The pandemic hits. Things shut down. Plans change. But Moore pushes on. He dines with the homeless, and with mayors and with multimillionaires. Strangers shelter him for the night, buy him meals, show him the town, explain their histories. An Umatilla Indian in Oregon acknowledges with approval that he's going the wrong way, west to east, reversing manifest destiny. In the Columbia River Gorge, a Klickitat chief shares his enduring love of the Columbia River and its salmon. Recreational fishermen insist on giving him all their food and beer. At dinner after a treacherous lake crossing in Montana, a raw-boned cattle auctioneer tells him that he and his family were watching, ready to boat to the rescue. He attends concerts, pokes around museums, visits old friends, makes new ones. He even goes out of his way to meet America. In Bismarck, North Dakota, a farmer-turned-entrepreneur convinces him to get a tattoo. He chooses a memorial tattoo in honor of his brother Tom and listens to the life story of the artist, 42-year-old Lance Stephen Paulk II, who has spent more of his life inside penitentiaries than out, who has been a prison gladiator, who has done solitary next to Charles Manson. That night when Moore opens his journal, he sees it as July 13th, Tom's birthday. A beauty of a river is that it bears you along through seeming wilderness until it opens suddenly upon a town. This balance between nature and civilization appeals to the artist in Moore, who is at least as interested in people as he is in the land. At river towns as old as the country itself, he hauls his craft ashore. He's often swarmed by curious locals. Where did he say he'd come from? He's going all the way to where? In St. Joseph, Missouri, he is hailed by an extended family partying along the river. He cautiously comes ashore, and with amenities become part of the group. They thrust a glass of moonshine into one of his hands and a grilled brat into the other. Half an hour later, moonshine still in hand, he finds himself careening over the edge of Missouri banks into a dune buggy, a giant grin on his face. In Oil City, Pennsylvania, an 82-year-old former pastor named Gil Books greets him on the banks of the Allegheny. Books had known Verlin Verguger, considered by many to be the greatest canoeist in history, and owns a paddle that had belonged to the legend. Books has read about Moore in the paper and has come out looking for him so he could repeat the paddle. Stunned, Moore accepts the gift under the standing he will merely be its temporary custodian until someday passing it on to another enthusiast. It isn't all rosy. At a bar in Montana, Moore slips up and reveals his politics, something he promised himself he wouldn't do. The crowd turns on him and calls him, Neil Moore, descendant of pioneers pilgrim on a voyage of love of his country, an enemy of the United States. The next morning, the family has been hosting him shows him the door. But that is the only real stain on the trip. Any other time he expects danger or hatred, he founds the opposites. He tries to avoid places that might attract meth addicts, so at a campsite up on the Snake that looks a little sketchy, he is apprehensive when approached by a fellow camper. But despite missing an eye and being what society calls homeless, the man, Brian Benson, turned out to be anything but a threat. Over the years, he has equipped himself with a pretty sweet outfit for surviving in the margins of society, a 7x12-foot trailer with solar-powered air conditioning and a TV, and is eager to share whatever he can with anyone who needs it. Push comes to shove. I can feed myself, he tells Moore. Feed as many weary travels as I can. another eyed in Idaho, camped behind a church. Morris hears two men outside his tent raving in a drug-addled fury. They menacingly approach his flimsy shelter, commanding him to reveal himself. Shaking, he laces up his running shoes and readies his bear spray and buck knife. Eventually, they leave him alone. Then, strangely, in the morning, one of the men returns and invites him to coffee. Morris sits and hints a man's story of hardship and addiction, and they part friends. In Memphis, on the day of his 2020 election, the political tension is palpable. Private security tails patrol the streets. Moore takes a seat at B.B. King's Line Blues Club on Beale Street to see how things will go. He hears a commotion, not trouble, but laughter. Outside, a man is running with a flag in his hand in which he has printed, "Be cool, Memphis!" Lightening the mood, Moore gets up from his lunch to introduce himself to the man, who calls himself Downtown Tat. "What's the flag about?" Moore asks. "It's not just Memphis," Tat says. "It's the whole country. We just have to be cool. Be cool, baby." Americans, Moore decides, still don't know how to reconcile their politics, but they're quite capable of ignoring them. And when they do, the vast majority are happy to help, to share, to swap stories, and to form intense, however brief, connections. Whatever you might see on the news, Moore learns that out in America, people are still generous and curious, brave and resilient, still connected by the neighborly values he recalls from his youth. Because of the pandemic, the authorities closed down navigation on part of the Erie Canal, so Moore paddled its first half, Buffalo to Syracuse, then walks the remaining 170 miles to Waterford and the Hudson River. If you think a long-haul canoeist on a river is a curiosity, one wheeling his loaded boat on the road. The second December of his expedition is coming on, and he wants to make it Manhattan before the lower Hudson notorious winter winds and choppy waves. He is right on schedule. On December 14th, 2021, shortly after his 50th birthday, Moore makes his final approach to New York City, and there's a picture of him standing in front of the Statue of Liberty holding a flag that says 22 Rivers by Canoe. The press comes out to observe the eccentric in his moment of triumph, and a contingent of kayakers and canoeists put in to join his victory lap around Lady Liberty. But near the George Washington Bridge, the winds come up so strong that he ends up with his bow pointed north, and he can't safely turn it south again. Hell, he thinks, this whole trip has been out going the wrong way. Anyway, so he paddles stern first the rest of the way. Hard to believe it is coming to the end. Tears well up, and not from the wind. Immense above his puny craft looms the liberty and light in the world. Crowded in the harbor are bobbing boats filled with friends and journalists and gawkers marveling at the magnitude of his accomplishment. 7,500 miles, 22 rivers, 22 states, 22 months, just as he said he would do. His mother would be proud. He had done something transformative, something pure. But it's over now, and he wishes he could just keep on paddling. That's driving a hard bargain. Not to brag, but I just filled up the gas tank and doubled the value of my car. Amen to that. Well, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. As we know, we like cutting stories on these things of cutting importance. And the reason I'm saying that is because last week we did the best chef's knife for you and how to use it. And we went through the different types of knives and how much they cost and such. Now let's say the only three knives you really need. Manufacturers love to bundle stuff you don't need with must-have items, and it's even to be dazzled by those big 12-piece knife sets in their handsome maple blocks. But most of those sets are a waste of money, designed for a different era and filled with knives you'll rarely use. A carving knife, for example, once an essential tool for slicing your Sunday roast, will probably emerge from the block only around the holidays. And even then, it's just as easy to carve a turkey with a chef's knife. Here's all you really need. 1. A great chef's knife. A good chef's knife will cut about 95% of everything you need to cut in a kitchen, says Brandon Lewis, a chef. You're far better off putting your entire budget into one great chef's knife as opposed to blowing it on a big mediocre set. A recent survey supports this thinking. Participants said they use their chef's knives for everything from mincing herbs, slicing veggies, to dicing tofu, and even deboning and spot-chalking chicken, less than $20 to $200 and up. A serrated bread knife. The 5% of foods you can't cut with a chef knife can be cut with a bread knife, Lewis says. Serrated or scalpel teeth can slice through delicate foods without exerting too much downward force to crush them. Among the foods that benefit from such treatment are crusty baguettes, soft loaves of white bread, and tomatoes. The Heckles Forge Premio, $55, and Worcester Classic 8-inch, $135. Bread knives are solid choices that match two of our favorite chef's knives, $5 to $60 and up. And a small paring knife. Although not essential, a 3 to 4-inch paring knife can be nice for small, fine tasks like cutting strawberries in half, and they're from $7 to $95. Now, maintenance. How to use a knife. The Consumer Product Safety Commission staff reports that an estimated 435,000 adults landed in an emergency room as a result of a cutlery mishap between 2016 and 2020. With the right cutting technique and the best sharpening and cleaning practices, you can safely significantly reduce that risk and will reduce your food prep time, making cooking that much easier. The safer way to hold a knife. Holding your chef knives the right way maximizes control, improves speed, and minimizes the likelihood that you'll cut yourself. The pinch grip. The best approach is to use what professional chefs call a pinch or pincer grip, which provides the perfect blend of control and leverage. Choke up on the knife so you're pinching the blade between your thumb and index finger, says Brandon Lewis, a professor of culinary arts at Johnson & Wales University, and your last three fingers are wrapped around the handle. Your index finger will be bent, not extended, next to the blade, and you should be pinching the blade just above the handle where it meets the blade. Then there's the standard grip. If the pinch grip feels unnatural or unstable, even with practice, try the so-called standard grip, instead where you wrap all five fingers around the handle. If a knife still feels unwieldy, consider downsizing from standard 8-inch knife to a 6 or 7-inch one. Control your digits. Never place your thumb or index finger on the back of the blade or on top of the handle, because it will cause you to lose some control. If you feel the need a finger to push the blade through food, it probably means your knife is overdue for sharpening. The best cutting techniques. Holding your knife correctly in your dominant hand, your non-dominant hand should safely position foods as you cut. Curl your fingers so the tips are gripping the food and the portion of your fingers between the top and middle joints are parallel to the blade, with thumb and pinky tucked out of the way. That way the blade slide simply rubs the flat part of your fingers. How to chop garlic. On a cutting board, lay your chef's knife over a clove of garlic, peel on, and smash down with your other hand to break off the skin and flatten the clove. Slice across the entire flattened clove to get the pieces smaller. Rock your knife over the garlic until it's finely minced with your non-dominant hand on the back edge of the handle. How to slice an avocado. Oh, this is always fun. With the avocado on its side of a cutting board, make one light cut around the perimeter. Pick up the avocado, twist to separate the two halves, and use a spoon to remove the pit. Hold the avocado on the board with one hand while making cuts through the flesh, and peel, crossing the cuts to form diamond-shaped pieces. The hand holding the avocado should never be directly under the knife. Well, that makes sense. Hold the avocado in your hand and use a spoon to scoop out the diced flesh. How to cut a bell pepper. Cut off the top and bottom of the pepper about half inch from the ends. Stand the pepper upright and use the knife's tip to cut small slit through the flesh on one side. Don't go deep enough to reach the seeds. Unscroll and flatten the pepper and lay its exterior side down on a cutting board. Remove the clusters and seeds and trim away the white residue. Shake off any remaining seeds. With the exterior side facing the board, slice the flattened pepper into half-inch strips. Now that's something I never knew. That's really enlightening. Thank you. Keep your knife sharp. A sharp knife makes cutting not only easier, but safer. With a dull knife, you're forced to exert more pressure, making it more likely that the knife will slip, leaving you prone to injury, Lewis says. If your knife feels like it's dull, try what's called honing. Run the blade along a honing steel at an angle specified by the manufacturer. The sharp edge is fairly thin and can bend or curl in one direction over time. Honing can straighten it without grinding away a lot of metal to create a sharp edge. If honing doesn't do the trick, turn to sharpening using one of these tools. And they have the manual tool from $5 to $60. These handheld sharpeners have slots guiding the blade. You start at the blade's base and pull through in one steady motion. The pros, it's easiest for beginning to use. Cons, relatively slow. But that's not a problem if, as we recommend, you only have one or two high quality knives to sharpen. The best manual sharpener is the Chef's Choice Model 4643 for $60. Electric. These devices sit on a countertop and have grooves for holding your knife at the correct angle as you drive it through. From the pros, that's speedy, easy for beginners. The cons. The sound of grounding metal can be a little intimidating at first, and if you don't pull the blade through smoothly and quickly, it can wear down too much in one spot. The Chef Choice Model 15XV3 stage at $180. And the Whetstone, $10 to $90 and up. By the way, the electric is $20 to $210. After soaking the stone in water for about 10 minutes, you drag your knife across it at a precise angle, taking care to do the same number of strokes on each side of the blade. For the pros, this can deliver superior sharpness. A tool called a bevel edge, sold at hardware stores, can help you find the right angle. The cons. It requires a lot of practice to do it correctly. And the thing about that is the Sharp Pebble Premium Whetstone for $40. And treat your knife right. Cleaning your knife. Always clean it by hand in a dishwasher. Blades can easily bang into other items and get nicked. The very hot water and drying can wreak havoc on handles, and it's easy to cut yourself when pulling a sharp knife from a tightly packed dishwasher. To wash by hand safely, hold your knife securely at the handle with the blade tip facing away from you. Fold the soft side of a soapy sponge across the blade and push from base to tip. Storing your knife. Wood blocks and wall-mounted magnetic strips are both fine for storage. If you want your knives out of sight, considering a block designed to fit inside a kitchen drawer, or if you're going to store them in a drawer with other kitchen tools, buy protective plastic sleeves made specifically for chef knives. The cardboard holder your knife came in is meant only for temporary use. Chop on this. With the perfect knife in hand, you need the right cutting board to use it on. Two, in fact. One for meat and one for everything else. Raw meat and seafood can carry harmful bacteria, so have a cutting board just for them, says Sajum Adid, PhD, Manager of Food Safety and Testing and Research at CR. Is plastic safer than wood? Not necessarily. Either can be used for cutting raw meat and then disinfect it. But plastic does have an advantage. The easiest way to sanitize a cutting board is with the high heat cycle of a dishwasher, and wood boards are generally not dishwasher safe. You can sanitize wood boards by soaking them in a gallon of water treated with a tablespoon of bleach. Looks aside, the biggest difference between wood species is hardness. Firmer wood like hickory dull a knife more quickly and offer a less satisfying grip as you cut. Softer woods like teak or maple provide a better grip, but get more unsightly gouges, which harbor bacteria. If your wood board starts to look weathered, you can sand it down and reseal it with mineral oil. Plastic cutting boards. Best plastic boards are the original Gorilla Grip cutting board, $24 for a set of three. These stay sturdy on countertops. Their surface has enough grip to provide grip, but is firm enough to resist gouges. Each has two usable sides, one with a groove around the perimeter to catch liquids, and the other flat so you can scrape food directly into a bowl, and they're dishwasher safe. That's nice. Sturdy and reversible, the OXO cutting boards, $24 for a set of two. Like the Gorilla Grip boards, these are sturdy, reversible, and dishwasher safe, and provide just the right amount of hardness beneath a knife to offer grip without gouges. The lone drawback is size. At only 7.25 by 10.75 inches and 9 by 12.9 inches, neither is big enough to easily prep for a large crowd. And then you have the budget plastic mats, $10 for a set of four, the Corolla Flexible Plastic Cutting Board Mats. These cutting mats are flexible, so you can curl them into a funnel-like shape to slide chopped ingredients into a pan or bowl. Each has a food icon, cow, fish, chicken, tomato, to help avoid cross-contamination. They slip a bit on the counter, so you may also want a sturdier board for heavier tasks. And wood cutting boards. Best wood board is Teak House Traditional Edge Grain Collection Professional Cutting Board, $100 and up, I guess, though not very practical for routine kitchen prep. This massive board is a beauty and feels great under your knife. The size and look also makes it perfect as a serving board. Its sheer heft makes it hard to clean thoroughly at the sink, so avoid using it for meat. Budget wood board, John Boo's 16-inch maple edge grain and chop and slice reversible cutting board, $46 and up. Simple but effective, this board provides a good knife feedback and is big enough for most tasks. It comes in larger sizes with a groove for catching liquids. It must be hand-washed and periodically resealed with mineral oil you can buy online or at a houseware store. For serving only, totally bamboo cutting boards, $18 for a set of three. This trio of boards is best not for cutting on, but for serving cheeses or sliced veggies. The smooth surfaces slip on countertops, and the bamboo is very hard, so you feel like you're damaging your knife with each cut. These two are hand wash only and need periodic resealing with mineral oil. And let's switch to the road report. Money saver. What color car is the best for resale? If you like yellow, go for it. While most new car purchasers choose white, black, gray, or silver, a new study from iCars.com suggests that buyers might choose neutral colors because they wrongly believe that's what the next buyer will prefer. The study, which analyzed sales data from more than 650,000 vehicles from the 2019 model year, found more eye-catching colors, especially yellow, held their value better. Often, colorful cars are sporty or have more expensive trim packages, a notable factor. If a neighbor's tree falls in my car, who's responsible? Unfortunately, you are in most circumstances, as would be the case if a neighbor's tree fell on your home's roof. It is your responsibility to make an insurance claim, says Loretta Waters, a spokesman for the Insurance Information Institute. Such car damage is covered under the comprehensive portion of your car insurance, minus the deductible, if you have comprehensive. With hurricane season upon us, now may be a good time to raise your concerns with your neighbors if they have trees that look unhealthy. The vital statistic, 16%. The amount your car likely has appreciated in the last year, its value has grown even more, 51% since the start of 2020. New car prices haven't seen as dramatic an increase. There may be an advantage to selling your car for a new one. And there is a recall from Ford. Ford is recalling almost 3 million cars and SUVs, including the 2013 to 2019 Escape SUVs, 13 to 18 C-Max hybrids, 13 to 16 Fusion sedans, and 13 to 21 Transit Connect vans, and 2015 to 2018 Edge SUVs, because they may roll away even if they appear to be in park. The problem is due to a bushing that may degrade or detach. Call Ford dealerships, will replace the bushing and add a protective cap free of charge. For more information, contact the Ford Motor Company at 866-436-7332. Now here's an interesting list of statistics. Brands that cost less to own. The least and most expensive car brands to maintain and repair at 5 and 10 years, based on the data collected from CR members. The price you pay to buy a car is only the beginning of what can ultimately cost you. A CR analysis shows that on average, members spent $208 a year for repairs and maintenance on a car that is 5 years old. That number nearly doubled to $406 on the 10-year-old model. Annual ownership costs can vary significantly by brand. For instance, at the 10-year mark, on average, Cadillac owners spend at least $225, while BMW owners spend $911. Several domestic brands are among the cheapest to maintain, including upscale autos from Buick and Lincoln. The sixth least expensive. CR experts say that the large production volume and lower parts and labor costs are the main reason that many U.S. luxury brands are less expensive to maintain than premium European models. Depending on the brand, maintenance costs can add up significantly over time, says John Ebbetson, CR's chief mechanic. Knowing how much others have paid in ownership costs can help you determine whether a new or used car is within your budget. And I'm going to read from the charts of the five brands with the lowest and highest maintenance repair cost over a 12-month period, from among the 26 brands included in the analysis. Okay, the least expensive, the five brands with the lowest ownership cost, after 5 years, Cadillac cost $106, Buick cost $121 annually, Toyota $183, Chrysler $150, and Mazda $209. After 10 years, however, Cadillac is $225, Buick is $244, Toyota is $298, Chrysler is $300, and Mazda is $302. Now, the most expensive, the five brands with the highest ownership cost, starting with the Mini Cooper at 5 years, it's $280. The Volvo is $373 in the first 5 years, and the Mercedes-Benz is $490 in the first 5 years, while the Audi is $244 and the BMW is only $201 in 5 years. However, those numbers change with the 10-year. The ownership, the expensive for the Mini, after 10 years, it's $508 a year. For the Volvo, it's $616. For the Mercedes-Benz, it's $817. For the Audi, it's $840. For the BMW, it's $911. I guess that means you should probably get rid of your BMW after the fifth year. Let somebody else suffer the cost. And for the last 8 minutes or so, let's just pop around in the next Consumer Reports. Making poultry safer to eat. There's simply too much dangerous salmonella in the poultry we eat. Almost 1.25 million people get sick from the bacteria every year, and about 1/5 of those cases come from eating chicken or turkey. The reasons are fairly well known. One is the crowded and dirty conditions in which chicken are often raised. Another is the Department of Agriculture actually allows poultry producers to sell meat that may be contaminated with bacteria. That's right. While poultry producers must routinely test for salmonella, up to 9.8% of whole chickens, 15.4% of chicken parts, and 25% of the ground chicken they test may contain the bacteria. Even at higher amounts, the USDA doesn't stop the plant from selling meat. It just issues a warning. To investigate the danger of this regulatory gap, CR recently tested ground meat, which is especially likely to be contaminated with bacteria, that we purchased at stores around the U.S. We found an extremely dangerous strain of E. coli in one sample of ground beef, triggering a large recall, as well as salmonella in 23 of 75 ground chicken samples. Most of the salmonella detected was one of three strains that pose particular threats to human health, and all were resistant to at least one antibiotic. After we published that report, the USDA announced a plan to no longer allow salmonella in frozen raw breaded chicken products, a step forward. But CR thinks the U.S. Department of Agriculture can do more by reducing the amount of salmonella allowed in all chicken and by focusing on dangerous strains. Consumers currently have little visibility into companies' greenhouse gas emissions and other climate impacts. So CR supports a rule proposed by the Securities and Exchange Commission that will require many companies to make climate-related disclosures. While that's a positive development, CR believes the rule should be made even stronger by requiring all companies to disclose so-called Scope 3 emissions, which include those from transportation and shipping, and can make up the majority of greenhouse gas emissions for some businesses. Fighting for fair insurance. What's at stake? With consumer goods, if a price seems unfair, you can choose not to buy the product. Not so with auto insurance, which drivers are required to have in almost every state. That makes it especially troubling that car insurance prices are often calculated unfairly. Specifically, CR has found that they are often tied to non-driving factors such as education level, home ownership, and credit score. In New York, for example, CR found that someone with a clean driving record but poor credit paid on average $1,759 per year more than drivers with excellent credit. Among other problems, non-driving factors can sometimes be proxies for race or ethnicity, and using them can compound the economic effects of structural racism and discrimination. How CR has your back. CR has long fought to ensure that auto insurance pricing be based only on driving factors. Three CR investigations in 2015, 2017, and 2021 exposed companies that deviate from that principle. And in 2017, we helped persuade New York to ban the use of education and job status in car insurance pricing, unless insurers could prove that they're not unfairly discriminatory. Now CR is supporting legislation in New Jersey and New York that would ban such practices more broadly and require more transparency into pricing formulas to make sure they don't contain built-in biases. What you can do, if you believe you're being overcharged for auto insurance based on non-driving factors, share your story with us at cr.org/carstory. Ask our experts. I've been seeing a lot of good deals lately on refurbished cell phones. Is it wise to buy one? A refurbished cell phone may be a good choice. These used phones should generally be purchased at a significant discount, sometimes $100 or more off the price of a new model. But keep in mind that companies may define refurbished in different ways, potentially making some a better deal than others. Refurbished phones offered by manufacturers and cell phone carriers are generally certified pre-owned, which means they are used phones, likely returned or traded in, that have been inspected and sometimes upgraded with new parts. They usually also come with a generous warranty. For example, refurbished iPhones directly by Apple are restored with the same parts used in new models. They also have a new battery, outer shell, cables and accessories, and even a fresh white box. Refurbished iPhones come with a one-year warranty, too. Samsung uses similar standards for its refurbished phones, with a new battery and a one-year warranty. But some major retailers don't promise these kinds of upgrades. Amazon says that refurbished Amazon Renewed phones are inspected and that any faults are replaced, but the battery may only at 80% capacity, unlike a new one. Walmart sells refurbished phones without the original packaging and may include a genetic charger, which would work fine, it just won't be manufacturer branded. Amazon and Walmart offer a 90-day warranty, There are also refurbished phones sold on third-party online marketplaces such as Newegg, but some sites don't include a warranty at all. Our experts say to avoid refurbished products that don't have a warranty of at least 90 days. Will eating foods containing added MSG make me sick? There's no evidence that MSG, monosodium glutamate, a food additive that combines sodium with a naturally occurring amino acid glutamate, has any ill effect on us. MSG is added to foods such as canned soup, soy sauce, and some snacks, like Doritos, to give them umami, a complex savory flavor. The concern that MSG makes people feel bad is probably a result of the single 1968 report published in the New England Journal of Medicine, blaming headaches and nausea on potentially eating MSG. News of this single report became widespread, but there was no scientific research then or now showing MSG to be harmful, says Kadantha Shelke, founder of Corvus Blue, a food science and research firm based in Chicago. In fact, scientists have not been able to consistently find any reactions to MSG in people who identify themselves as being sensitive to this additive. Nevertheless, if you're concerned that you may be sensitive to MSG, cut back on eating processed, packaged, and restaurant foods that contain it. Also know that while MSG is fine to consume, in moderate amounts, it has 480 milligrams of sodium per teaspoon. The daily recommended for sodium is less than 2,300 milligrams. And since we're about out of time, let's run out a couple of jokes to end the day. This is laughter the best medicine. After trick-or-treating, a teen takes a shortcut home through a cemetery. Halfway across, he's startled by a tapping noise. Trembling, he spots an old man chipping away at a headstone with a chisel. "Huh! I thought you were a ghost," he cries, the relieved teen. "What are you doing working so late?" "Oh, those idiots," grumbles the old man. "They misspelled my name." Can we have a word? The most embarrassing thing about Wordle is that when I don't get it in three, I'm convinced I'm about to learn a brand new word, and then it's like, THOSE, those. If you're being chased by a pack of trachydermatists, do not play dead. The linguist husband caught her in the arms of another. "Susan," he said, "I'm surprised." "No, I'm surprised," she corrected him. "You're astonished." I like to imagine the guy who invented the umbrella was going to call it the brella, but he hesitated. A man hates his wife's cat, so he drives it to the park and leaves it. As the man arrives home, the cat is walking up the driveway. The next day, he drives the cat to the next town, boots it out, and heads home, and there was the cat. Finally, he drives 20 miles, turns right, then left, and over a mountain to a thick forest and leaves the cat there. Hours later, he calls home. "Jen, is the cat there?" "Yes," she says. "Put it on. I'm lost, and I need it to give me directions home." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks so much for listening. Until next week, this is Jim Cronin.